WBEZ is supported by Shedd Aquarium, where animals, people, science, and conservation come together. Through community outreach, education, and research, Shedd protects the water that supports life in the Great Lakes region and beyond. More at sheddaquarium.org. Shedd Aquarium, for animals, for people, for communities, for love of waterkind. This WBEZ podcast is supported by Wise, the app for international people using money around the globe. With the Wise account, you can send, spend, and receive in up to 40 currencies with only a few simple taps. Download the Wise app today or visit wise.com. Terms and conditions apply. Be smart. Get Wise.
Governor J.B. Pritzker making his first public remarks since the team announced it's advancing talks with Hammond.
There was some discussion with the city of Chicago after they told everybody that they wanted to be in Arlington Heights. It's confusing. Which one do you want?
Well, former Chicago Mayor Rahm Emanuel wrapped up his bike tour through New Hampshire.
Do we assume you're all in? Are you running for president?
You can make whatever assumption you want, but there's no decision until I make the decision.
Hey, Chicago, I'm Sasha Ann Simons, and this is In the Loop. It's Friday, so it's time to look back and break down the big stories of the week in our weekly news recap. Residents are still recovering from the tornadoes and thunderstorms that caused widespread damage and power outages across the Chicago region. Calls grow for Chicago's U.S. attorney to resign. Plus, the CEO of Chicago Public Schools faces tough questions from Republicans during a congressional hearing.
The head of Chicago Public Schools was in the hot seat in Washington today.
Republicans have threatened to withhold funding over policies for trans kids.
Do you think it's appropriate for boys to sleep in the same room as girls on field trips?
Chicago Public Schools policies are in alignment with the state of Illinois.
U.S. Attorney Andrew Boutros is facing criticism and calls for his resignation.
You know, it's extremely unusual for us to get this kind of a glimpse into the proceedings before a grand jury.
We'll get into those stories and much more, but let's start today's episode with a closer look at a series that you can read in the Sun-Times and hear on WBEZ. With me to discuss is WBEZ's senior editor, Alden Lowry. He's one of our panelists this week. Hey, Alden. Good
hey,
to see
Sasha.
You.
Hey, Sasha. Same here.
So you've been working with our CPM colleagues on a series about the history of black churches in Chicago. So tell us about the latest story that you're working on.
Sure. This latest story is the third in a five-part series. We're looking at a church that has built a reputation over the last four decades of really focusing on the issue of housing. The church essentially created a nonprofit community development organization in the historic neighborhood of North Lawndale, which is a neighborhood that has its own legacy of issues with regard to housing. Martin Luther King, when he made his trip to Chicago for several months and engaged in a lot of work around essentially creating safe and affordable places for African Americans to live in the city. North Lawndale was the place where he set up shop. He moved his family, rented a dilapidated apartment in North Lawndale. And 20 years after the non-binding agreement that King struck with Mayor Richard J. Daley back then, when not a lot of progress was made, this church, Lawndale Christian Community Church, stepped forward and said, we're going to kind of keep the mantle of King's work alive. Mm-hmm. And they created this nonprofit. And this nonprofit, like I said, for four decades has been doing work to help connect people with affordable rentals and pursuing homeownership opportunities.
This series from reporter Nicole Janine Johnson has been just so eye-opening and just so rich with like great characters. She's meeting a lot of people, talking to a lot of great folks. And it seems like Chicago's black churches were really just like a one-stop shop, if you will, right? They were this hub for not just faith, but for social justice movements and a way for black residents in particular, to unite and also to take action.
Yes,
wouldn't you say?
Indeed. Yeah. We've dubbed it the Faith in Action series. And we started with two very prominent historic churches and delved into very difficult spaces during, just the time, before emancipation. And then during the Great Migration and ways in which they were helping black folks not only have a church home in the sense of a church home, a religious home, but also a home for all of those other needs that they have. And one of the things that we've loved about the series is that those were historic churches, but there are also churches today that are doing similar work. They're offering people a spiritual home, but they're also offering a place for Black residents in the city and communities surrounding these churches an opportunity to take advantage of things that they need.
Fascinating stuff. We look forward to checking this one out once it's published online and in the paper next week, right?
Yes.
All right, let's jump into the recap. Thank you so much for stopping by, Alden.
Of course.
Also at the table to help make sense of the week's news was Carrie Shepherd, Chicago reporter with Axios, and Dan Petrella, a political writer for the Chicago Tribune. Now, we started our conversation by talking about the weather on Wednesday and Thursday. Tornadoes and up to 80 miles per hour winds shattered windows downtown and took down trees and power lines. The CTA's Yellow Line was shut down for 2 hours early yesterday. This was due to a fallen tree limb on the tracks near the Oakton station in Skokie. Service was halted this morning on the South Shore line connecting Chicago to South Bend because of damage. And ComEd reported some 200,000 customers throughout northern Illinois lost power. So I asked the panel if anyone lost power or had damage from the storm. Carrie went first.
Slight flickers, but I was a little worried because we live in a high rise and there were high rise windows. I don't know if you guys saw that. There were windows that were smashed out. So I was a little worried about our windows because
yes.
I'm not sure how new they are.
Sure. Yeah. And, that's a good reason to be worried.
Yeah. And we saw some trees down. You know, there were some trees in the neighborhood that had like fallen on people's cars. And but I know the south side was really hard hit. I talked to some people who live south who said that ComEd said they're power wasn't going to come back on until Saturday, and that was yesterday.
Mm-hmm.
So that's rough. You know, you have to clear out your fridge, you know, that you've got no hot water. So I wasn't as badly hit as that.
Yeah, a lot of folks still waiting for power, still cleaning up, still waiting for city crews to come out and clear some trees that have completely blocked streets.
Yeah, I was spared any real damage. I had flickering lights at a couple moments. I did have a friend who needed to drop by my place to pick up something on Wednesday and was told that, you know, they said they had to redirect themselves like three or four times because there were a bunch of downed trees.
Oh, yeah, sure.
I mean, Hyde Park. So, yeah, I can only imagine. And we just did an item yesterday where we found that there were close to 5,000 requests, 311, around downed trees. And the most, like in a two-day span from essentially Wednesday night into Thursday, that we've seen in at least 7 years or
goodness.
So.
Wow.
Dan, how were things for you?
Not too bad. We heard faintly the tornado sirens in the near west suburbs where we live just about as we were getting our kids to bed last night, so had to get them out of bed and get them down to the basement for a little while. So,
dramatic.
Yeah. Not too bad, though. Although they, of course, still woke up just as early, so I didn't get quite as much sleep as I had hoped before coming in this morning, but all good. But yeah, tree limbs and stuff all over the places I was coming in today.
Yeah, the National Weather Service says there's still a threat for severe weather tomorrow. No tornadoes, but the possibility for damaging winds and damaging hail. So stay tuned here on WBEZ for weather updates, of course, throughout the day. All right, in other news, Chicago Public Schools Superintendent Macklin King was in Washington Wednesday. She was testifying before a congressional committee. I want to play a little bit of a question that Illinois Republican Congresswoman Mary Miller had for her.
When will CPS come into compliance with President Trump's order and stop teaching hypersexualized curriculum?
CPS is in compliance with all local, state, and binding federal law.
So, Carrie, Superintendent King spent a lot of her time on Capitol Hill talking about CPS's LGBTQ policies. Fill
us in. Yeah, I'm not sure what hypersexualized curriculum is. I'm not sure if Mary Miller explained that. But this is part of this ongoing effort from the Trump administration. She was, Macklin King from CPS was there with San Francisco's head of schools, also Loudoun County outside D.C. in Virginia. And this is this idea of, quote unquote, parental rights. This is, you know, a lot of the Trump administration, you know, and Macklin King is correct. They follow state law, which says that schools and educational, you know, settings have to adhere to a student's gender identity. Okay. So, you know, she's following the state law. CPS is following the state law. But these Republicans that were sort of coming at her were saying, look, you know, this, the executive order of Trump says this is not how it works. And so she defended it. I don't think she defended it as vigorously as maybe San Francisco did.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, she, right. Yeah.
Well, the Trump administration already pulled a $20 million federal grant from CPS over its Black Student Success Plan. I mean, did Republicans grill her about CPS policies toward Black students?
They did a little, I believe. I didn't watch the full, but it was mostly about transgender students, but also there
and
was
the sex ed.
Sex ed, an issue, a question of like how early is too early to give students condoms was a question. And I think that maybe probably threw her for a bit of a loop.
How do you think the superintendent came across, Dan and Alden?
You know, these congressional hearings are always so much more for show than any sort of actual like policy making policy, you know, driving policy. So I think it's a very hard position to be in. You know, I think she acquitted herself fairly well. Some of the questions are designed to try to trip people up to score political points. That's really
sure,
what
right.
someone like Mary Miller is interested in doing. They're not seeking real informational answers to these questions. They're creating sound bites for social media, for campaign ads and things like that. So, you know, it's a very difficult situation for anyone to go into. And I think, you know, she handled herself
yeah.
fairly well.
I mean, she was really composed, particularly given the moment. You know, I agree with Dan that this is, I think, largely a stage for particularly for Republican lawmakers to kind of ground themselves with their political base that, you know, these are things they believe in. And also kind of continuing this narrative around how these core issues and values are under threat mm-hmm. from mm-hmm. radical members of the left. So I thought one thing I did find was interesting, you know, Carrie pointed out that she, King, was not as vigorous in kind of defending the policies at CPS as her San Francisco counterpart was. Because the CPS has already lost $20 million
right,
in federal
right.
funding. And I think there's a sense like, hey, I don't want to poke the bear here. I want to, you know, kind of stand my ground, but I don't want to do anything inflammatory that might
right.
exacerbate.
I feel like there's so many things at play there. She's also fairly new to the job.
Exactly.
Right?
And they have a massive budget, you know, hole as it is right now. I mean, like she said, this is not what's coming up at board meetings. Parents aren't standing up there and saying, what about overnight trips? I don't know if CPS even takes overnight field trips. You know, that if students are in the same, you know, bathroom or whatever, mm-hmm. it's more that what are the cuts going to be? Are we going to have special education programs? What are the teachers going to be? Are we going to have enough librarians? Those are the bigger issues that parents are worried about.
Right. All right, Alden, let's turn to something very different. Chicago police are investigating what may have been a hate crime in Grant Park. What are the details?
So we don't know a whole lot. What we do know is that Chicago Fire Department put out an object on fire around 2:30 in the afternoon on Tuesday, and police are, it was a cross. It was a burning cross. Mm-hmm. There was a passerby who actually caught video of it, posted it to YouTube, spoke with Black Club Chicago, who had a story on about this. And so there was certainly some reaction to it. St. Sabina Church, Michael Flager, Reverend Flager, has offering $10,000 for any information about how this happened, who's responsible for it. That's about all we know. The authorities are investigating, but as yet, there's no suspect. No one's been held in custody or anything like that.
Right.
But as you might imagine, the impact of such an event,
seeing a burning cross in the heart of downtown in 2026,
it's a moment. It's quite a moment. Even just hearing you say it out loud, it evokes a certain kind of emotional response.
For sure.
Yeah.
I thought they had an image of somebody? Did I see that? There was a video
there's
still
a
of
video
somebody?
There's a video still of someone walking away from the scene.
Got it.
You know, that is the alleged suspect.
I see.
There is a person of interest that police are looking into.
Yeah, it's interesting. Governor J.B. Pritzker is actually at the Rainbow Push Coalition annual conference that's going on. Spoke at the end of the day yesterday and sort of was re-eulogizing Reverend Jesse Jackson and also doing a little bit of campaign stump speech, but also alluded to this cross burning and, you know, this fact that this symbol of the KKK in the middle of one of the most diverse cities in the country in 2026 is kind of a representation of the moment we're at politically.
Yeah. Carrie, newly released grand jury transcripts revealed alleged misconduct by federal prosecutors. Mm-hmm. What did we find out this week?
This is in the Broadview 6 trial we've heard a lot about, which actually was ultimately down to four people. Two of the defendants' charges were dismissed earlier, in March. So this was during a grand jury. The transcripts were released. April Perry, the judge, asked for these, and it was shown what some are saying, not just some, like more than 110 former federal prosecutors also agree, that there were some improprieties done by one of the assistant U.S. attorneys in those grand jury hearings, in that there was some sort of vouching going on. This is this idea that this AUSA was kind of, instead of just presenting the evidence as objectively, she was sort of trying to steer the jury one way or the other. Mm-hmm. I think we all saw the headline that one of the jurors said, "I heard this case last week. It was a crock of blank then. I still think it is." And she dismissed the juror, which is usually left to the chief judge to do. So we saw this kind of behind the scenes that you don't often see with grand juries, right? So I know that John Seidel, your colleague, has been on a lot talking about this. This really goes behind the veil of this pretty secretive process. Mm-hmm. But ultimately, the feds dropped the charges because it would seem to appear that they also agree maybe there were some improprieties done. Boutros also, the U.S. attorney for the Northern District, appeared in front of the grand jury. Sources I talked to said it wasn't so much that he's appeared, that has happened before. It's what he said.
Yeah, there are concerns being raised about him,
right,
too.
Right. In this transcript, at one point he says, "I know some of you," I'm paraphrasing, obviously, "I know some of you have issues with some of the cases like this, immigration cases, and we have, a process to deal with that." Well, what does that mean? It sounds a little like, if you're not going to, it sounds a little bit threatening, but the DOJ has defended Boutros. I don't think he's, it doesn't look as though he's going to resign, as our U.S. senators have called for.
Yeah, a growing number of folks are calling for him to resign.
And
Tammy Duckworth, Quigley.
Right. And to be clear, the former prosecutors who put out this public statement did not call for that. They basically said, "We're very concerned about the future of this office that we served under and we've worked for. And there's a lot of concern that a lot of young people, mm-hmm. young prosecutors are not going to want to work in this environment. So there's going to be a lot of vacancies."
Dan, the U.S. Attorney's Office of Northern Illinois is also being accused of misconduct in another case involving COVID-19 testing fraud and an ex-Loretto Hospital executive. So just remind us what this case is about and how these Broadview 6 transcripts we just heard about fold in here.
Yeah, I was just going to say it's really having a ripple effect because this the same prosecutor, former assistant U.S. attorney Sherry Mecklenburg, was involved in this case that goes back to the pandemic. Loretto Hospital's on the west side, a hospital that serves a large low-income population, actually has a lot of state legislators who have and do serve on the board of the hospital. There's this COVID testing fraud scheme that was going on. It was about an $800 million scheme involving the former CEO and a few executives, one of whom is in jail in Serbia right now awaiting extradition. Late yesterday, there was going to be even more of a sort of curtain thrown open to what goes on in the grand jury room in this case. But they dismissed charges against two of the defendants in that COVID-19 fraud scheme, basically to prevent more digging into what was going on in the U.S. Attorney's office and in the grand jury rooms. And there's another case, a case where a gentleman pleaded guilty to bank fraud and is serving a sentence, and now his attorneys, who happens to be also the attorney of one of the Broadview 6 defendants, or former defendants, I should say, is asking for them to reexamine that case as well because the same prosecutor was involved.
Goodness.
So it really, I think, is
quite the domino effect.
Yes, undermining confidence in a U.S. attorney's office that has a strong reputation. Obviously, we saw lots of public corruption convictions out of this U.S. attorney's office over the years, lots of other high-profile cases that they've won. So it's been an interesting past year in the U.S. attorney's office in the Northern District.
Yeah, hearing scheduled for June 17th could force top officials in the U.S. attorney's office, including Boutros, to testify under oath about grand jury issues and attempts to cover them up. Alden, to Dan's point a moment ago, is this alleged misconduct causing not just judges, but you think maybe the public to lose trust in the DOJ?
I would say for sure. I mean, I think particularly in this administration, there's been a sense the Department of Justice, the entire mammoth institution, has been weaponized in some way. Mm-hmm. And so I think the public has awareness of that. And then when you get on a granular level in this particular environment, and as Dan said, this office has actually had, I would say, a pretty strong
record of kind of weeding out a lot of the corruption that mm-hmm. Chicago has become known for, unfortunately, and for there to be questions about the way the department is bringing these charges forward, particularly for an institution in the grand jury process that a lot of people just don't have any real information or insight or knowledge about, is, I imagine, even more troubling.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's this idea, too, of the DOJ's, I mean, as many have said, is this question of competence there. And we saw this a lot with the Operation Midway Blitz. You know, repeatedly those were dismissed because these attorneys were showing up and they were unprepared. Mm-hmm. They weren't, you know, the April Perry, the judge, was like, you know, you're not answering my questions. And to Alden and Dan's point, too, I mean, when we see with the Loretto case, this really affects people. This is all this money that was happening in this crisis period, yeah. And this is a public safety net hospital that weren't getting access to. I mean, it's going to start trickling down even more. That it's going to affect everyday people, and we're going to really question who is defending. You know, who is defending?
That's right.
This WBEZ podcast is supported by Wise, the app for international people using money around the globe. With the Wise account, you can send, spend, and receive in up to 40 currencies with only a few simple taps. Download the Wise app today or visit wise.com. Terms and conditions apply. Be smart. Get Wise.
Last Friday, around lunchtime, the Bears dropped a bombshell, which sounded like the team was moving to Hammond, Indiana. But by the end of the day, that alarming announcement just, I don't know, for me at least, it felt very confusing. Remind us what happened, Alden.
Sure. So the Bears, like you said, last Friday, made an announcement that they are, quote, they're going to advance our stadium development project in Hammond. And they mentioned that the board of directors on the previous day, on that Thursday, had decided to move forward with their plans to build a stadium in Indiana. And they talked about how it was going to transform the region and so on and so forth. However, as the Sun-Times reported, a source cautioned that Friday's announcement didn't eliminate Arlington Heights from consideration, were the state able to find a way to give the Bears the property tax certainty that they wanted at that site. So, yeah, it's... very confusing. I think many of us were unsure what to make of all of this.
And listen, Governor Pritzker is just as confused. I want to play a little bit of his analysis of this Bears stadium story.
There were some fumbles that occurred by the Bears, beginning with a press conference with the mayor of Chicago talking about a multi-billion dollar stadium that they wanted to have built with taxpayer dollars. That's not something I was ever willing to do. They never asked. They just held a press conference. That was the start of some of the fumbles.
What is the likelihood, Dan, that the governor or the General Assembly will call a special session here?
I'm very skeptical of the idea that there might be a special session. If you think back a few years when the Supreme Court overturned Roe versus Wade, they were going to call a special session on abortion issues, which is a issue very near and dear to the governor's heart, and it never happened. So the fact that they would call folks back to Springfield before an election to deal with this stadium legislation is not entirely credible in my mind. I think the big caveat that the governor gave was that you have to get the House and the Senate on the same page on what legislation they would be voting on. So I think it's much more likely, if it happens to happen in the fall veto session in mid-November or early December. And I think, you know, sort of folks at the state level are waiting for the Bears to weigh in mm-hmm. on, and I think the governor even said, weigh in publicly on which of the options that's been presented to them from the legislature they would support, or if they'd be willing to accept either. And then the other question is, this happens in the legislature all the time where you've got two different versions of an issue that get passed out of each chamber, and then the other chamber lets it sit on the shelf. We saw this for years with the elected school board in Chicago, for example.
Right.
So, you know, I think it's going to take leaders getting together over the summer and figuring out. And the politics of it are very tricky, especially for Democrats, because they don't want, especially for a Democrat who's a billionaire like J.B. Pritzker, they don't want to look like they're bending over backwards to make special deals for billionaires.
Sure.
They know people will be mad if the Bears leave the state, but people will also be mad if, you know, their property taxes go up or their taxpayer dollars are going to a franchise that's worth $5 billion right. or whatever it is.
So, Gary, set the record straight. Are the Bears packing their bags for Indiana?
Oh, my gosh. Like, I have an insight to Kevin Warren.
Was this just another negotiating strategy?
It seems like a game of chicken, right? Like dancing. Actually, I thought maybe, and this shows, you know, I don't totally know the issue as well as I thought maybe there would be a special session. I mean, this is going to look, as Dan pointed out, very bad for the governor, but mm-hmm. also for, if this happens, our mayor, or if he's running in 20, if he is or isn't running in 2027. If
Brandon Johnson, yeah.
If we lose the Bears, that's going to come down on them. I mean, I talked to a lot of people who are like, I'm over it. I don't care. Go to Indiana, whatever. Yeah, but I do.
Sasha points to self.
I think a little easier said than done. I think that a major sports city like Chicago and like such a deep legacy like the Bears, that to lose our NFL team would mm-hmm. just be a total mark on us. And yeah. I think people would think it was poor leadership.
Alden, what are you hearing from Chicago's South Side residents? Are they, you know, maybe thinking a move over the state line would benefit them?
I think from a practical standpoint, there are folks on the South Side who are like, you know, hey, this might not be such a bad thing.
It's a few minutes away.
It's a much shorter drive. You know, whatever might get built up around the stadium could also become a point of attraction for folks on the South Side, particularly the Southeast Side. But I do think, at least in my circle, you know, just a lot of really devoted Bears fans who just see the Bears as Chicago's team. I think it would hurt just seeing the Bears go to Arlington Heights. I think that would hurt. If you ask me, it hurts as much to see them go to Arlington Heights as it does to see them go to Indiana.
Interesting.
And actually, I would prefer Indiana if they're going to not be in Chicago. I would prefer Indiana because, yeah, it's a much closer drive
right.
for me than Arlington Heights. I'm like going to Arlington Heights
I was literally just in heaven a couple of days ago, and I was like, well, this isn't half bad.
right.
I started picturing what life would be like. Yeah. You know, how are Northwest suburban leaders and residents reacting to the Bears' latest announcement, Dan?
You know, I think that they are maybe taking the Indiana issue a little more seriously than some folks maybe in the state house are. I think, you know, obviously they have more to lose. There's a lot of economic development that would come along with a new stadium being built and potentially this big mixed-use development they want to build around it. But, you know, I think there's also folks that are concerned about their property taxes and traffic and all sorts of issues that would come along with building a stadium there. So, you know, I think hearing from folks around Arlington Heights, you know, around the village, they've taken this Indiana issue maybe more seriously than others. I think even before the big letter came out in December that they were really moving forward with the idea of Indiana. But I think, you know, the announcement last week from the Bears was very typical of how they've handled this whole process, mm-hmm. where they seem to be moving in one direction, but they leave just enough shadow of a doubt to kind of leave everyone confused about where they're going. And mm-hmm. just like they did when they allowed the mayor to sort of sow this seed of doubt in the middle of the last month or so of the legislative session about Chicago still being a possibility, which gave legislators, particularly in the Senate, an excuse not to vote for a bill that would help the Bears move out of the city if, you know, the city was still on the table, which I don't think it is. There's not really, you know, the lakefront site's not going to happen without the taxpayer dollars. And the Bears have been presented the site at the old Michael Reese Hospital, which they're not interested in. So there's no real site in Chicago that has been identified where they would build. So, you know, it's going to be Arlington Heights or Indiana, I think, but which is still, I think, very much up in the air at this point.
This is In the Loop. I'm Sasha Ann Simons. Welcome.
Exhaustion.
If you just got here, that was the sound of my exhaustion. We're going behind the headlines in the weekly news recap and talking Bears with Dan Petrella of the Chicago Tribune, Carrie Shepherd of Axios, and WBEZ's Alden Lowry. So Carrie sort of alluded to this earlier, but I do want to get all your thoughts on how this entire stadium saga could impact both Mayor Johnson, who is, you know, in this mayoral race that's less than a year away, and Governor Pritzker, who, you know, many are speculating maybe he could be considering a presidential run. What comes to mind, Alden?
Well, I think about, particularly around Mayor Johnson, is that I don't know if there's much to lose. Well, I should take that back. There's a lot to lose. He needs a win the way I don't know any sitting mayor needs a win. If he were able to figure out how to keep the Bears in Chicago, I think that would probably be worth his time and attention. But as we've said, that doesn't seem to be a real possibility. But in the grand scheme of things, you know, he's in some really choppy waters right now. I don't know if losing the Bears necessarily is going to make it that much worse for him.
Mm. Dan?
Oh, I'm sorry. I think it would probably lead people to re-up the criticisms that there have been, and Dan knows this well, being when he goes to Springfield, that, you know, Johnson's not, he doesn't have that deep relationship that maybe Daley had and Emanuel had, and Lightfoot had a little bit of a shaky relationship with Pritzker in Springfield, but they're going to hit on, well, you didn't come down here enough. I think we saw that. He was sort of like in the final days of the session, like, oh, hey, good to see you, you know, like that. So they're going to maybe, you know, go after that, and that you need a symbiotic relationship with Springfield and Chicago if you're going to get anything done.
Yeah. What do you think, Dan?
Yeah, I think so. And I think, you know, like the governor alluded to, when the idea of building the stadium in the city was reliant on the state putting money into building a stadium and the city not putting any money in necessarily in terms of at least the construction of the stadium, it was a good deal for Johnson because he could get a new stadium in his city and not have to, put the bill on his taxpayers directly necessarily. I think for Pritzker, it's hard to say. You know, obviously you already see Darren Bailey, his Republican opponent in the November election, attacking him on this. But I think Bailey would also find a way to attack him if he was doing something to keep the Bears and say, you know, they're bending over backwards for billionaires overworking people. So, in terms of his longer term future, I think, you know, it's hard to say, you know, like when the legislature and Governor Jim Thompson cut a deal to keep the White Sox back in the 80s, the politics of the issue were very different than they are now. I think, you know, there's lots of public opinion polling and economic research that shows these stadium deals are not good for taxpayers in general, and taxpayers don't like them. So I don't think, there'll be some pain of losing the Bears if they go to Indiana, but I think, you know, Jets and Giants fans in New York have gotten used to the idea of their teams playing across the border in New Jersey. So I don't think the long-term damage will be that great.
It'll be doable, folks. Governor Pritzker is not the only one from Illinois that people are speculating might be making a run for president. What is former Chicago mayor and Illinois Congressman Rahm Emanuel up to?
He's logging a lot of miles on his bicycle. first, I think in Iowa, and now most recently in New Hampshire. Obviously, very different topography in those two states, but what they have in common is they're both early primary states, early caucus states, and sort of places where people go to lay the groundwork for potential presidential campaigns. Yeah, it's just interesting. I think, he's been slightly out of the public eye for a while, but he's been very good recently at inserting himself into the conversation quite a bit. And, you know, the big question is
appearing courtside at the Knicks game.
Yeah. Does he see himself as a real potential contender for the nomination, or is this a move to sort of set the conversation to sort of try and pull the party back toward the more moderate, centrist, sort of Clintonian positions? Or, does he really think that he's got a legitimate shot at being the nominee?
Well, let's listen to a bit of Emanuel. Here are some of the concerns that he says New Hampshire residents shared with him while he was pedaling 113 miles across the state.
You hear the same constant refrain about this kind of sense of middle-class squeeze. Mm-hmm. The world you and I grew up under, the world that we hope our own kids grow up under, is changing not only dramatically.
And you say Democrats have lost the plot on.
They totally lost the plot. Everybody has lost, actually, not just Democrats.
Alden, Emanuel also weighed in on the issue of sports and taxpayer funding, not about the Bears, but the World Cup, which had its first game yesterday. But we're not going to be having any games in Chicago, right?
Right. I mean, largely because of former Mayor Rahm Emanuel. He talked about the deal that FIFA wanted the city to sign on to, that they wanted him to sign on to. And he felt like was just going to be giving up too much in terms of Chicago taxpayers. And the deal that they were offering Chicago is essentially, from what I understand, the deal that they offer many of the cities that are talking about for host cities. They want them to cover a lot of the setup, a lot of the management with regard to public transportation, security, you name it. Think all of the things that come along with hosting a massive event where you've got literally hundreds of thousands of people coming into your space to attend. But meanwhile, while those costs are borne by the cities who are hosting, FIFA is walking away with revenues from ticketing, from broadcasting, from concessions, from parking. They also are restricting the marketing deals that the host cities can be a part of. Mm-hmm. So anything that is essentially if it's a competing interest to a marketing partner of FIFA, they don't want you to do anything like that. And then there are other kinds of restrictions like that to protect kind of FIFA's footprint in terms of who their partners are. So, you know, Emanuel said this, we're giving up too much. And for him, the straw that broke the camel's back, he told The Athletic, was they wanted the deal to include essentially allowing FIFA to make a request for a dome to be placed on top of Soldier Field.
Oh, wow.
And the mayor joked about it in the interview with The Athletic. He said, you know, they said, oh, that's not a big deal. We ask that of everybody. We never exercise
we don't
it.
Do it.
And so he's like, okay. Well, I can't give you just a blank check for something that would be that incredibly expensive to construct.
And Emmanuel wasn't the only one, the only mayor to turn down the World Cup, right? Big cities like Phoenix and Denver and Detroit. I mean, they're also not hosting, and I think probably for similar reasons.
Yeah, like Alden says, FIFA takes the revenue. The cities pay for, you know, they pay for the security and all the costs. And so, and the, you know, the stick they wave in front of them is like, but look at all the tourism you're going to get. And rightfully so, then Mayor Rahm Emanuel was like, I don't really need the World Cup. People come to Chicago. This is the third biggest city. You know, we've got tons of other things happening. And boy, did that story of his come at a really good time during his New Hampshire. I have to say, my colleague Justin Kaufman wrote about it before The Athletic, before everyone. And, you know, I think that Rahm Emanuel's people are really happy to see that. So he's really playing that up. Oh, yeah.
Well, listen, Carrie, we're not able to go to any World Cup games in Chicago, but there are some cool places
we can
watch. We can travel.
Yeah.
But we can also just stay right here and watch them.
Yes.
And take part in the action. What are some of your suggestions?
Well, yeah, there are a ton of matches in the World Cup, more a lot. But we have a strong soccer culture here, obviously. So, you know, the Globe is like up in North Center is like a very well-known soccer bar. Like it was just voted, I think, by like USA Today, one of the best in the country. There's a new place in Westtown called Soccer House. This is where the old Twisted Spoke was. That's all dead. They're playing every single match. Lots of places are playing, rightfully so, the hospitality industry doing what they should do. They're playing into the idea with like these specials of like, you know, a drink that's, you know, the origins of the country that's playing that day.
Cool.
Yeah,
it's a
cute, good idea. And sports brings us together and Cubs are kind of faltering. Sox are, you know, so like it's always nice to have somebody to root for. And it also shows like what I love about World Cup, it just shows the massive multicultural
exactly.
of our city.
Love that summer excitement. World Cup, Olympics, bring it all to me.
I mean, remember Poland and Mexico played a few years ago and it was crazy exciting.
Dan, Governor Pritzker has hit the pause button on tax incentives for data centers. These have become controversial, right? So talk to us. Did the governor explain why he made this decision?
Yeah, and some of that controversy is part of the reason. There were a few legislative proposals this spring that would have put some new restrictions for data centers, including, you know, making sure that they are not overtaxing the energy grid or the water supply, you know, making sure that the process of zoning and approving permits and things for them is more open and transparent to the public. Those things didn't make it through the legislature. And so he is pausing an incentive that actually was part of a budget deal that he made back in 2019 in his first months in office. This was actually something that he negotiated with the Republican minority in the legislature. This was a priority for him, but something that at the time I went back and found the press release they put out when he signed these into law, and he said, in today's world, data centers are as critical a part of our infrastructure as roads, trains, and schools. And obviously, this was long before you know, the big AI boom that we've had in the last couple of years and the explosion of these data centers and just the amount of computing power that is needed to power things like ChatGPT and the Gemini stuff from Google that is infecting every app and email and thing that I use from that company. So, you know, I think the state just wants to take a little bit of a measured approach. It's not canceling any of the incentives that are already on the books, but starting July 1st when the state's new budget year begins, pressing the pause button, like you said, to give the legislature and the governor's office time to kind of figure out how they want to go forward with this issue.
Yeah. Good call.
Yeah,
take a second here.
I think with like as advocates continue to raise, you know, the point that the data centers are what's driving up power, electricity, utility rates. We're going to see this maybe with water. Lot of people are being hit by that. So people are making that connection. So, you know, it seems like the right time to respond in some way.
Well, I just wish they could put a pause on all of the Gemini prompts that that we keep getting.
Oh, Gemini. I mean, that thing is so annoying in your Gmail. No, I don't want you to help me.
It doesn't go away.
All right. Steering the conversation over to another topic. It looks like passengers will be able to keep riding the dog into downtown Chicago. A city council meeting approved the $19 million purchase of the Greyhound bus station in the South Loop. I mean, it's not like Chicago has a lot of spare cash lying around, Carrie. What drove the alders to do this?
Well, so it passed committee and then it will go to the full council. Just this idea that, you know, a major city and a transportation hub like Chicago not having an intercity bus route. I mean, a lot of people who I think I saw some of the reporting people spoke to and some of the people who testified at the hearing said, you know, for a lot of people who go to U of I, this is how you can get from Chicago to Urbana. You know, people who, you know, don't have cars, this gets you out of state where there are no Amtraks or trains. This has been an issue for a few years because the idea that was initially proposed was by the company that bought the Greyhound station there was, well, okay, we'll drop off people at Union Station. Union Station was like, whoa, we've already got a lot going on there. There were questions and issues of crime around the area, but the fact of the matter is, I mean, that you have to have a Greyhound station in a city like Chicago where people really depend on it.
Yeah. So, and you got a lot of low-income residents relying on Greyhound as well.
Absolutely.
So the curbside pickup idea was just not...
Right.
Not friendly.
And to say that they're not going to have a place to go inside in the winter when they get dropped off. There's no place to go to the restroom or get food. And so, yes, the city does not have a lot lying around, but this could be a good move by the city to keep this service available.
Well, there's a lot of excitement, Alden, for next Friday's public opening of the Obama Presidential Center. What are you hearing from folks?
I would say a range of things, but generally speaking, there is a lot of excitement, a lot of anticipation. This is literally like it can be a crown jewel of a kind of a attraction to the South Side. It's honoring the nation's first black president, a Chicago son, you know, some degree. certainly the place where he launched his political career from. And so I think, yeah, the people are excited that it's going to be there. It's going to be opening. People get a chance to take a look at it. Some of us who haven't been privy to get inside just yet.
Everyone stares with envy at Carrie.
but I would say things are generally positive. But yeah, there are some concerns about what the long-lasting impact will be of the center on the neighborhood surrounding it. And then also questions around, just... when we look back on 20 years, what will we ultimately say this meant? So there is some reflection around about that as well.
Well, Carrie, give us your first impressions since you took a tour.
I did. Well, you need more time. I didn't even get to see the grounds and the public library. There's a new public library branch that's beautiful. I was just thinking, we were laughing when Alden said that about a Chicago son, because, you know, Barack Obama obviously wasn't born here. But, you know, something that I found really striking and important is that the Michelle Obama's life in Chicago and roots in Chicago and history in Chicago are just as well documented almost with Barack Obama's. And I really appreciated that. She talks about her roots in South Shore and going, you know, there's even like a little... kind of plaque that she got for being in the honor roll in 1980 at Whitney Young. Michelle Obama is an icon in so many ways. And so I thought that was really great. And I loved seeing her awesome dresses in there and everything. And
yes,
as a art fan, the art that's in there is quite striking and beautiful. They've got some major artists. They commissioned some major modern artists to do work in there.
I have not been, but I did. A close friend did get a chance to tour. And what she described to me, which I thought was really incredible, was how grounded the presentation was of Chicago and Michelle Obama's story, but also just kind of black Chicago in some respects. They really kind of take you through a history tour of that. So I think once people get inside the space, there will be an even greater appreciation.
Yeah. It was such a nod to Chicagoans. Like it's when you watch the show Southside and you're like, if you know, you know, you know, there's a lot of moments where you're like, oh yeah. Like
I recognize this. I recognize that.
Yeah. I love that.
Dan, you haven't been in, but what are you looking forward to?
I have not been in. I am looking forward to the whole thing. I think, as a former resident of Springfield and a big fan of the Abraham Lincoln Presidential Museum and Library down there, I'm interested to see sort of the comparison there, these two, iconic, important presidents who came through Illinois. Abraham Lincoln also not born in Illinois,
right?
Yeah, and I think I'm interested too, you know, down the line to see how people feel about the building maybe 10 or 20 years from now. I think there's a little bit of mixed feelings about the architecture of the you know, sort of
the brutalist style
monolithic building itself. But we've seen that with other buildings too in Chicago, where they're really controversial at first and then become kind of beloved or like the Thompson Center, where it was sort of controversial at first, and then there are people who learned and grew to love it, and people who still hate it to this day.
And this isn't the only change coming to the South Side, Alden. The Quantum Computing Campus is another massive development scheduled to open next year. Are hopes high for what this could mean for all of the South Side, or are there some concerns about gentrification? Because that tends to come up too.
Yeah, I would say yes to all of that. There was a number of organizations have, you know, just kind of formed kind of like a coalition around this development. There is a lot of high hopes. Thing to keep in mind, like this site, this Steelworks site has been vacant for literally generations, mm-hmm. and so. The fact that, and there have been a number of proposals for the use of that land over the years, some of them thwarted by all of the remediation and everything that needs to happen with the land there. But this feels like a project that is actually, you know, like we're on the precipice of this thing becoming a real thing. I think it does have the potential. Some people see it as really having a transformative effect. Now, the question is, what kind of transformation will it be? And so there are a number of groups that are actively protesting this. Some of the same groups who've raised concerns around the Obama Presidential Center as mm-hmm. well. This is a great opportunity. It sounds like an amazing project. And the question is, dropped in the middle of a community or communities that are very fragile, if you will, economically, are we putting up the kind of guardrails that are necessary to make sure that the people who've lived in these communities for decades have the opportunity to take advantage or to benefit from, I would say very clearly are going to be benefits that come along with it. So,
well, let's stay on the South Side for just another moment, because there's another reason to celebrate. The White Sox are in first place in the American League Central for the first time since 2021. I mean, not to jinx anything, but does it feel like something special is happening with the team?
I would say something special is happening, but let's be careful about what we define as special.
Wins.
And isn't that a novel thing for a baseball team?
The bar
to win.
Was a little low.
The Sox had lost 100 games 3 consecutive years, which is something that's only happened a few times over the history of baseball. And the middle year of that 3-year stretch, they lost 121 games, was the most any American League team has ever lost. So the fact that here's the thing, that season they only won 41 games.
Jeez,
they've
Alden.
Won 36 games already. So something special is happening in that regard.
So I was right.
Yes, but if we're talking about like, are they going to the World Series or even to the playoffs or all of that, I would pump the brakes on that. I'm happy with 36 wins by June 12th. That makes me over the moon. But we'll see. They got a young core. They've got a lot of good things happening. The manager seems to be doing a pretty fantastic job so far. So all signs are pointing up for the White Sox.
Okay.
It was Wednesday's win that put them in first place, right? Is that correct?
I believe so. Only by half a game, mind you.
I have to say, I'm going to credit the Tribune, because we had a whole crew of folks there who were there celebrating our prize win from earlier this year. So we were the good luck that got the ball.
Oh, it was you. Okay.
I say that as a Cubs fan.
I would say the one game I went to, they were losing so far this year. And as soon as we left, they won. So I'm fairly bad luck.
You are the bad luck. And Carrie, close us out with this. A story that you wrote, it was about a change coming to the popular Taste of Randolph Food Festival.
Yeah, this was last week. So street festivals, as we know, in Chicago cannot charge admission because they take over public roadways. So they often, as we've seen, they do the suggested donation of anywhere between $10 and $20. It depends on who you are. You pass right through and you say, hey, I pay for these streets. I'm a taxpayer. Or you throw them some money because these are not funded by the city. These are private groups, often chambers of commerce, that pay for these. What we've seen, and I've heard from organizers over the last year, is that fewer and fewer people are giving that donation. So they're struggling with production costs, security, et cetera. Taste of Randolph is a huge one. They're doing something different. They're not posting a suggested donation, but instead you can enter to a raffle. Mm-hmm. So you can enter to win some sort of prizes, thinking that will incentivize people maybe to give some money because they say, oh, yeah, you've got something. And, you know, because if you get into a street fest, you still got to pay for beer. You got to pay for food.
I wonder if others might take their lead.
That's what I'm interested to see, too, especially like the Wicker Park Fest, some of these big street festivals for sure.
Yeah. Well, that is it for the weekly news recap. My thanks to Carrie Shepherd of Axios, WBEZ's Alden Lowry, and Dan Petrella of the Chicago Tribune. Have a great weekend.
Thank you.
Thanks.
This episode of the In the Loop podcast was produced by me, Andrea Guffman, and edited by Ethan Schwab. Sasha Ann Simons is our host. For more in-depth coverage of news and culture in Chicago, be sure to subscribe to this podcast. For a full archive of the show, head over to wbez.org/in the loop. Thanks for listening.